B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, October 19th, 2017. I want to honor my mother. She would have been 94 today. She passed away just after her 93rd birthday last year and lived a long and very bountiful life. And it's also my oldest brother Tom's birthday. He was born on the day Mom turned 25. We've got lots of news today. I hope I can squeeze it all in the time that you have. You may recall I've been talking much this week about the 60 Minutes broadcast Sunday and the companion Washington Post expose about the opioid crisis, and the CBS and Washington Post focused on the role of drug distributors in really amping up the distribution of the highly addictive opioid drugs that have led to millions of people addicted and tens of thousands of deaths every year. And I've raised other questions that weren't addressed in either the Post or the 60 Minutes broadcast, such as, how much money do members of Congress receive from the drug industry and the opioid people in particular? Well, today it didn't come from the Washington Post or the New York Times or any other mainstream media outlet here, but Britain's online newspaper, The Guardian, with the headline, How Big Pharma's Money and Its Politicians Feed the U.S. Opioid Crisis. And I characterize this as a deep addiction to the drug money that leads to these addictions and deaths, and that Congress itself is deeply addicted to opioid cash. And I've criticized Trump for the way he, and pardon my language, but he sharted and soiled his pants at the news conference that was hastily called Monday when Mitch McConnell and he finished up lunch at the White House. And we'll get to the sordid discussion of how to console the families of active combat service members who are killed in the line of duty. But at that same news conference, Trump announced that he was going to look into Tom Marino, the Republican congressman who has since withdrawn from the nomination as the so-called drug czar, and we can credit his scalp to 60 Minutes and the Washington Post. But here's what Trump said about the drug industry. They contribute massive amounts of money to political people. Standing next to Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader from Kentucky, which is a state hard hit by the opioid crisis, I don't know, Mitch, maybe even to you. Now, in that moment, Trump, who I have a hard time agreeing with or finding common ground with on almost anything, he blurted out the truth. Pharmaceutical companies spend far more than any other industry to influence politicians. You remember a few years ago, Dick Durbin, the number two Democrat in the Senate from Illinois, he said, you know, Washington is owned by the banks. Well, not as much as the drug industry. Hundreds of thousands of dollars have gone to McConnell himself, although he's hardly alone. 9 out of 10 members of the House of Representatives and all but 3 of the United States' 100 senators have taken campaign contributions from pharma companies seeking to affect legislation on everything from the cost of drugs to how new medicines are approved. The pharma people has about 2 lobbyists for every member of Congress. They spent $152 million on influencing legislation just last year. Drug companies contributed more than $20 million directly to political campaigns last year, and about 60% went to Republicans. Who's the single largest beneficiary? Paul Ryan, the Republican Speaker of the House. He raked in $228,000 and change. Then there's Jason Chaffetz. He left Congress earlier this year, but he was the hard-hitting chair of the House Oversight Committee, running those politicized investigations. The single largest donor to his reelection campaigns, over $200,000 in total, came from the pharmaceutical industry, and he led an effort against advocacy by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to reduce opioid prescribing by recommending that doctors first seek alternative treatments for chronic pain And the AMA knocked that back, saying, oh, doctors don't need any more training. And this really is just a powerful snapshot of how Congress is owned, lock, stock, and barrel. And while they fulminate against meth and, marijuana in many cases still, they're silent about the opioid addiction crisis, the deaths that result, and their own deep complicity. And the Guardian article quotes members of Congress, Hal Rogers, and the former representative from Southern California, the Palm Springs area, Mary Bono, because they made repeated efforts to pass laws curbing the mass prescription of opioid painkillers. And what's interesting is they cite Mary Bono here as alerted to the opioid crisis after her son, Chesar, who was fathered by Sonny Bono, became addicted. But let me remind you all that Sonny Bono was a member of Congress. Mary Bono took his seat after he died, and he died while playing hooky from Congress, skiing at my favorite resort at Lake Tahoe, while he was loaded on Vicodin. And Sonny Bono died by skiing into a tree while he was using these kinds of painkillers. Now, I want to note that Vicodin, I don't believe, is as dangerous as OxyContin. But the irony here is something that should not be lost. Mary Bono is, while she doesn't mention her late husband, she said, we were getting tremendous pushback from the industry, a massive, well-organized effort. There's the Pain Care Forum, which has spent $740 million over the last 10 years lobbying in Washington and state legislatures against limits on opioid prescriptions. So this is a very insidious problem. And as you know, I am loath to praise Trump, and I'm about to continue my usual posture here. But in this case, he actually told the brutal truth. Now today, my stomach turned. Just minutes ago, before I sat down to record this podcast, I reviewed my news sources and learned that the White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly, has demagogued the issue of how a president consoles the survivors of a soldier who is killed in combat. And this, of course, is complex, and it is driven by the known fact that John Kelly lost his own son in combat in Afghanistan. And he's been extremely private about this. It was Trump on Monday at that same news conference, and that's why I used the term sharted, because when asked what happened to those soldiers who were killed in Niger near the border with Mali, Trump responded with this bizarre defensive attack on Barack Obama for the way he honored the military's dead. And yesterday, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, she dirtied the water even further by claiming it was disgusting that people in the media and a Florida congresswoman had used this issue in some kind of a sordid way. And both Sanders and John Kelly ignore that it was their boss, the Donald, who opened up this whole issue and turned it into what is now a four-day ugly story. And now it's made even uglier, because John Kelly made an unannounced appearance at the White House press room today, breaking years of silence over the death of his own son in Afghanistan. He said he was brokenhearted by the politicization of troops who died on the battlefield. Quote, it stuns me that a member of Congress would have listened in on that conversation. Absolutely stuns me. He said he was so incensed by the episode that he walked among the gravestones at Arlington for an hour and a half on Wednesday. Quote, again, I thought at least that was sacred, but it was eroded a great deal yesterday by the selfish behavior of a member of Congress. Now, all she did was expose the bizarre phone call that Trump made to the widow who was on her way to the airport in a limousine with the congresswoman, her mother, and I believe at least one other family member. They were going to the airport to pick up the remains of her husband, who had died in the event in Niger. And so this is the kind of demagoguery that is part of Trumpism. And to see John Kelly lower himself, he never mentioned that Trump was the one who initiated this whole round of discussion, if you will. He did acknowledge that he hadn't received a phone call from Obama at the time, but he said that wasn't a criticism, it's not a negative thing, I'm just affirming that what the president said was true. But this is just so, so ugly. And I return to a theme that I've been raising in conjunction with this whole story and the exaggerated coverage that it was getting. I think this deserves more coverage, I'm sorry to say. And this morning I went to get my teeth cleaned. And Jerry, who is the dental hygienist, is a very political, progressive woman. And while she's got all that gear in my mouth, she loves to ask me questions and talk about stuff. But before I even got in the chair and she had a chance to, gag me with those instruments. She said, "Hi, Peter, how are you? What the hell were those soldiers doing in Niger?" That was her first question. But the media's not exploring that. They're exploiting this blunder by Trump. And again, that's not completely unjustified. But we need to go deeper. What is the mission? Why are we there? Who sent them there? What is the legal authority? What is the exit strategy? What does a win look like? And who the hell are we fighting? I heard Rachel Maddow describe it as the Islamic State. I believe it's al-Shabaab. But in any event, we as Americans have not been briefed on this military intervention in Africa. And George W. Bush is one of my least favorite people, least liked presidents in my lifetime. But he managed to work his way through a speech. He's not a very good public speaker. But the text that he recited, and maybe he even wrote it himself, I don't know, was a pretty powerful indictment of Trumpism without ever mentioning Donald by name. Bush said, quote, "We've seen nationalism distorted into nativism, forgotten the dynamism that immigration has always brought to America. We see a fading confidence in the value of free markets and international trade, forgetting that conflict, instability, and poverty follow in the wake of protectionism." Now, I don't completely agree with that, but it's his thought, and it is counter to Trump. He continued, "We've seen the return of isolationist sentiments, forgetting that American security is directly threatened by the chaos and despair of distant places." And he said much more. You might be able to capture this on a TV newscast. But without mentioning Trump, he said, "Bullying and prejudice in our public life sets a national tone, provides permission for cruelty and bigotry, and compromises the moral education of children. The only way to pass along civic values is to first live up to them." And Trump doesn't even attempt to do that. This morning, he was back on his Twitter machine, again attacking the FBI. Yesterday, he did that to kind of soften up things for Jeff Sessions' trip to Capitol Hill. And today, he is suggesting, and he is misleading us in this suggestion, that the FBI paid for the so-called dirty dossier that was gathered by former British intelligence officer Christopher Steele and delivered to an American company called Fusion GPS. Now, what's critical here is that the FBI did make a payment to Chris Steele, but it was after the election. And Trump doesn't honor that distinction and wants to lead people to believe that the FBI paid for the dossier when, in fact, Fusion GPS did. Now, Trump was reacting, and I share his outrage to some extent, that yesterday, employees of that company, Fusion GPS, invoked the Fifth Amendment in order to not testify before the House Intelligence Committee about the role that Fusion GPS played. We know that initially a Republican campaign entity or someone aligned with it paid for the investigation into Trump and Russia. And then when Trump secured the nomination, someone related to Hillary Clinton's campaign, we don't know who, picked up the tab for the continuing explorations by Christopher Steele. And so Trump here is once again trying to make it look like, you know, he's got nothing to hide and that this is all a Democratic problem. There is a meme going around on Facebook right now that even some of my progressive friends have picked up. A weak article from the Washington Times was started by Reverend Sung Myung Moon, a very politicized, biased outlet. And they're harping on a legitimate issue. The allegations of collusion between the Clinton Foundation and the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton around the sale of uranium to a Russian company back in 2009-2010. Legitimate issue. Been around for a while. It's not news. And the story made some, very fuzzy claims that there are new people who can corroborate this story, but it didn't name a single one of them. And so there are a lot of there are information wars that are underway, some to undermine or put pressure on the Mueller investigation, the special counsel, and some, I guess, just to advance the cockeyed thinking of Trump. And so I do think that Fusion GPS is much more significant than, for example, the whole bugaboo about Facebook ads. And we're going to get to that in just a moment. The unproven claims that, you know, Russia hacked the DNC, gave all that to WikiLeaks with the goal of electing Trump. That stuff's not proven. But Fusion GPS, we know, was at the center of collecting dirt on Trump. And they got it from sources in Russia. But there's still too much we don't know about that. So John McCain and two Democrats are moving to force Facebook, Google, and other internet companies to disclose more information about online political advertising. And I fully support this. They should not be immune from the disclosure requirements. You may know I've worked as a media consultant on political campaigns. And here in California, when we post an ad on the internet, we have to include a hyperlink to a page that shows who paid for it. That is not required under current federal law. The internet ads have been given a pass. They are not regulated by the Federal Election Commission. And one of the reasons is they say, well, those ads are too small to include that information. Just put a link. It's not that hard to disclose it. And Ann Revell, who is an honorable woman from California, she ran our election watchdog agency here, then was appointed by Obama to the Federal Elections Commission. She said it's ridiculous. We need to rethink all the exemptions for the internet because even if Facebook might not have known about the Russian advertising, they knew and we all knew that this was possible. And in the New York Times article that I'm reading from here, they reference, again, the way this is written is misleading. Facebook sold more than $100,000 worth of ads to a Russian company linked to the Kremlin. First of all, only 46% of the $100,000 was spent before the election. The linkage to the Kremlin, very fuzzy. Then they go on to say Google sold $4,700 worth of ads to accounts believed to be connected to the Russian government. And let's turn now to Bob Perry. Robert Perry at Consortium News has been the most credible critic of the whole Russiagate narrative, and he doesn't go after Rachel Maddow the way I do for her nightly telenovelas, which recently descended into coverage that the St. Petersburg firm that is linked to the Facebook ads had its team of hackers study the House of Cards TV series, as if that's how they learn to manipulate our election. It's bizarre. But to Bob Perry, I've linked to this story in the show file for the podcast today. He reacts to a comment from Jonathan Albright, the Columbia University journalism professor, who has been supporting the Trump-Russia narrative, for making the absurd accusation that the Russians have, quote, basically turned the internet into a sewer. And Perry says, look, I've been on the internet since 95, and the internet's always been a sewer. whatever some Russians may or may not have done in buying $100,000 in ads on Facebook or opening a couple of hundred Twitter accounts, the Russians are not responsible for the sewage coursing over the internet, because we didn't need Russian help to turn it into a sewer. And it's a great piece. He talks about the real situation, and then he quotes Mark Penn. You remember him? He ran Hillary's campaign in 2008. He has acknowledged the absurdity of thinking that such a piddling amount of money could have made a difference. In an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal this past Monday, he wrote, "I have 40 years' experience in politics. This Russian ad buy, mostly after the election anyway, simply does not add up to a carefully targeted campaign to move voters. It takes tens of millions of dollars to deliver meaningful messages, to the contested portion of the electorate." There's more in Perry's piece, and I encourage you to read it. And I also want you to link an op-ed that I've linked to in today's New York Times, penned by its columnist, Andrew Rosenthal. It exposes a leaked document, something leaked to Foreign Policy magazine, from the FBI's counterterrorism division, concluding that there is a real threat from the so-called black identity extremist movement. Quote, "Black identity extremist perceptions of police brutality against African Americans have been responsible for an increase in premeditated retaliatory lethal violence against law enforcement and will very likely serve as justification for such violence in the future." But Rosenthal asks, what exactly is black identity extremism? And he answers, nothing. Then he cites Andrew Cohen at the Brennan Center for Justice, who puts it in the right context. And this really resonates with me because my early career was based in part on exposing COINTELPRO and the racist efforts by J. Edgar Hoover to take down Martin Luther King. He succeeded. And in a memo that I held in my own hands with J. Edgar Hoover's initials on it to prevent the rise of a new black messiah, whether it's Malcolm X or Fred Hampton of the Chicago Black Panthers, who was murdered in a raid controlled by the FBI. Anyway, Cohen says, quote, "A history of surveillance. The FBI has a history of surveillance and intimidation of black Americans that frequently goes beyond legitimate law enforcement into paranoia, racism, and political expediency." In the document, Rosenthal says they take pains to say that the mere exercise of constitutional rights may not constitute extremism. But the danger is that the entire racial justice movement gets painted with the brush of terrorism. He references COINTELPRO, and he goes on to say that this new report conflates black political activists with dangerous domestic terrorist organizations that pose actual threats to law enforcement. And it's quite separate from the assessment of risk about white supremacists and other white nationalists here in the United States. Over the summer, I did two in-depth interview podcasts, one with the whistleblower from the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, a woman named Teresa Beasley, who had been recruited there to help counsel victims of sexual assault and try to reduce the incidents in the Air Force and at its military academy. We also interviewed one of the cadets, a former cadet, Eric Thomas, who was bounced out of the Air Force Academy just shy of graduation after he had gone undercover to expose the sex crimes of a football player and others who appeared to be protected in their predatory behavior. With that backdrop, and I encourage you to listen to both of those interviews, the Washington Post reports today a wave of new cases in which troops responsible for preventing sexual assault have been accused of rape and related crimes. Most recently, an Army prosecutor in charge of sexual assault investigations in the Southwest was charged with putting a knife to the throat of a lawyer he'd been dating and raping her on two occasions. In addition, a soldier at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, certified as a sexual assault prevention officer, has been convicted at court-martial of 5 counts of raping a preteen girl. That's not all. Eight other soldiers and civilians trained to deter sex offenses or help victims have been investigated over the past year in connection with sexual assault. The deputy director of the Air Force's Office of Sexual Assault Prevention at the Pentagon resigned last year after the inspector general rebuked him for making sexually inappropriate comments. Air Force members complain that the senior executive, Jay Onrud, made sexist remarks about tight pants and Hooters models. Despite the investigation, he's been rehired by the Air Force to work at the Pentagon on aviation issues. Back in 2013, the Air Force's chief sexual assault prevention officer was accused of groping a woman outside a bar. He was acquitted by a civilian jury but reprimanded by the military. Oh, and one more. An Army sergeant in charge of helping sexual assault victims at Fort Hood, Texas, was convicted of pandering for pimping female soldiers. So, we got a real problem with rape culture in this country. I'm not an expert on it, and I don't preach about Harvey Weinstein and these issues. I think that their behavior speaks volumes. There's not too much a dude like me can do to underscore that. But this is so offensive. And it hasn't stopped. Listen to that interview with Teresa. She paid a price because she resisted scrubbing the data on the number of sexual assaults at the Air Force Academy that occurred in 2015, and because she blew the whistle on a counselor, a male counselor at the Air Force Academy, who repeatedly hit on a female victim who came to him for counseling for sexual assault. It is totally outrageous. Every day I like to stop for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the PBC Podcast with your subscriptions. Wendy Gebauer, Paul Tomaselli, Cynthia Von Hendricks, and the esteemed Abby McMillan. They all make monthly kick-ins here at the PBC coffers. And I invite you to help out, too. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. It's easy. You click on menu. Then you click on become a subscriber. You hit the sign-up page, and you pick the level of support that's comfortable for you. And my subscribers today get first crack at my new in-depth interview that I'm posting this afternoon with a man who I was so thrilled to meet. He is the Chinese artist, activist, and persecuted citizen of China, Ai Weiwei. And in the interview, we initially talk about his powerful exhibit that was staged 3 years ago on Alcatraz, the prison island in the middle of San Francisco Bay. And then we talk about his powerful new documentary, which is called Human Flow. And the only thing that puzzles me is at the end of the interview, I asked Ai Weiwei, hey, what's coming up next? And he talked about promoting the film. But just about a week ago, he opened a set of 300 installations around New York City based around the concept of fences and borders to showcase the narrow-minded attempts to use to create some kind of hatred between people. And in this interview, I'm going to play an excerpt right now. Ai Weiwei talks about the film Human Flow, which covers 23 nations or zones where refugees have been displaced from their native countries.
Yeah, it's a film start with a natural one person's journey, which is me. I have no knowledge about what refugee is really about, so I have a strong curiosity to jump into the topic because it's a topic which is overwhelming. So by doing that, it seems very natural to use a language I'm familiar with, which is filming or recording or documenting, you know, or research. It's also things I'm very familiar with, you know, because I was doing this kind of human rights works in China, and, you know, we often have to do very quick response to those kind of tragic situation. And I did 10-20 films before. It's all for internet. It's everything to put in the theater.
As mentioned, the full interview with Ai Weiwei is available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com and all of our outlets except YouTube. For various reasons, the subscriber content does not go to YouTube, but you can find it everywhere else you access the PBC podcast. This may be just my personal interest, but I'm fascinated by what is shaping up to be a new Spanish Civil War. I have a print of Picasso's powerful painting Guernica from the last Spanish Civil War in the 1930s. And I've visited Spain a couple of times. Barcelona in particular is a place I love. And the Catalonian people are facing a showdown with Madrid. The leader of Catalonia sent a letter to Madrid, and he refused to abandon the push for independence, even hinted that they may declare independence if Madrid continues to block their efforts to establish some dialogue. But from Madrid, according to The Guardian, the decision has already been made to suspend Catalonia's autonomy and impose direct rule. There's a cabinet meeting called in Madrid on Saturday where this is apparently going to be approved. Now, the New York Times is not quite so certain. They say that Spain is setting the stage to take control and that it's not quite a done deed. In any event, this is going to be a very ugly showdown. And as you know, I support the aspirations of people anywhere to declare their independence and live free of what they consider to be outside influence or interference. And so we'll be watching this carefully. I want to credit BuzzFeed for disclosing a story about how a couple of days after the referendum, a group of farmers from Catalonia faked out the central government's police. They went to the border up north of Catalonia, the border with France, and they dropped hints that they were going to block the border. So the national police got there before they did, and after the farmers with their tractors and trucks and heavy equipment modified their plans, they closed the highway, the freeway, it's actually a toll road, between the French border and most of the area north of Barcelona. And they were able to trap the cops there for what is described as most of the better part of a day. I kind of like that stuff. The other day I reported on the truck bombing in Mogadishu, Somalia, that claimed over 300 lives and injured at least 400 more. According to the Associated Press, this led to widespread protests in Mogadishu yesterday, and some in Somalia have called this bombing their 9/11 and are demanding worldwide attention. I don't blame them. But in this AP story that runs about 400 words published in my local San Francisco Chronicle, there is no mention that this truck bombing appears to be in retaliation for an American raid that occurred in August where 10 civilians were killed. I guess there just wasn't room to include a reference to that in a story designed for consumption in the United States. Briefly, a federal judge in Brownsville, Texas today issued a ruling ordering the Immigration and Customs Enforcement people to allow an undocumented 17-year-old girl in their custody access to abortion. It's a complicated story, but this young girl fears reprisal from her family if she returns to her home country pregnant. And finally today, I was amused when I read this piece at Vice News because the headline is grossly misleading. It's not quite a listicle, but it says everything we still don't know about the Las Vegas shooting. They talk about the lack of hallway cameras at the Mandalay Bay Hotel. Why was the security guard Jesus Campos shot? Where did he go after the shooting? And I learned from this article that he popped up on the Ellen DeGeneres show on TV yesterday. And according to Vice, he didn't clarify much. Then they raise questions about Paddock's girlfriend, the shooter's motive, and where the money will go for up to $10 million that has been raised for the victims of the shooting. But they ignore the most obvious question that lingers. about this grisly event on October 1st. I'm sorry, it was on October 8th. I misstated that. And I want to thank a dedicated listener and a subscriber, Dick Attlee, who lives in Maine, who sent me a link to this YouTube video. And I can't vouch for everything that's in it, but I find the presenter, Mike Adams, who is generally known as a health ranger, he discloses that he's an expert on forensic acoustics related to weapons, and that one of his hobbies is long-range target shooting. So I'm going to play a couple of snippets from this, but I have linked to it in the show file for the podcast. And if you are still curious and skeptical about the ever-shifting narrative of the events of October 8th, I invite you to review it. It's about 30 minutes long.
All right, welcome to Forensic Acoustic Analysis of the Las Vegas Shooting. My name's Mike Adams, the health ranger. I am, of course, the lab science director of CWC Labs, as well as an avid long-range target shooter. And so I have kind of a unique position to bring you this analysis. Now, for those of you who are watching from law enforcement or the FBI, I'm going to give you the location of the second shooter. And if you're like, whoa, what second shooter? Just hold on. I'll walk you through it, okay? It's very simple. So this is...
Now, I'm going to compress this because I've already run over my general limit of 30 minutes today. But what he does is measure the acoustic sounds that he drew from real-time recordings at the scene of the gunshot sound that came from the gun that was used, whether it was in the tower wielded by Stephen Paddock or perhaps somewhere else. And he explains that the arrival of a bullet precedes the report of the gunshot by at least half a second. And that the frequency of the report, the sound of the gun firing, is much lower than the frequency of the sound of a bullet that is ricocheting or hitting or landing. And from that, he calculates that there was a second shooter. And here's a quick clip of where he confirms or affirms his analysis.
We have confirmation through this acoustic forensic analysis method that there is a shooter at 425 to 450 yards. But we also have another shooter that shows up in this acoustic analysis. This is the bombshell breaking news. Shooter number two appears throughout the audio files, and shooter number two has a lag time of 0.374 seconds. 0.374 is on this chart, go back here, 0.374 is between here and here, so it's between 200 and 300 yards. So we have a second shooter at between 200 and 300 yards.
There's much more in this package. Check it out and be skeptical. I think that that is advised. But given that the FBI is running the investigation, that the sheriff has changed his details several times, and that Campos has turned out to be at least a hard-to-track-down individual to talk about this, we deserve answers to the questions that remain, and Vice should be ashamed for not including the second shooter allegations in its wrap article. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast all the way to the end here. You can find it on YouTube. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.